This episode was conceived and recorded on a Miskwetchi-Waskahican, Beaver Hills House, Treaty 6 territory. Welcome to the Power Plant Sessions, the research security podcast produced by the Safeguarding Research Office at the University of Alberta. The Power Plant Sessions are recorded in the North Power Plant, a historic campus building that is now the home of the Safeguarding Research Office, the support unit dedicated to safeguarding research and innovation at the U of A.
This is Jacqueline Littlewood, host of the Power Plant Sessions. In this episode, we explore the relationship between the intelligence community and academia and what this means for research security. Our expert guests for the show include Jessica Adam and Stephanie Carvin. I thought it was a fascinating and rich conversation that can hopefully lay the groundwork for some concrete actions to build greater trust and collaboration between academia and the intelligence community in Canada. I hope you enjoy the episode, and I look forward to hearing your feedback. Hi there. Thanks for being here today. I wonder if we could start off with some introductions. Could each of you introduce yourself and the unique perspective that you're bringing to this conversation on the relationship between the intelligence community and academia? Stephanie, let's start with you.
So, hi, it's great to be here. My name is Stephanie Carvin. I am an associate professor at the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton University, where I teach in the areas of cybersecurity, critical infrastructure protection, as well as espionage and foreign interference right now. But I've also taught other national security courses in the past. I, in the past, have worked as an intelligence analyst with the Government of Canada. And so I have tried to spend most of my career here in Canada trying to bridge that gap between academia, the general public, and how national security works in Canada.
Perfect. You sound like the ideal guest. Jessica, you introduce yourself.
Hi, Jacqueline. I'm so thrilled to be here today. Thanks so much for inviting me to join this conversation. It's a real privilege to sit at the table with yourself and Stephanie. My name is Jessica Adam, and I'm the Director of Research Security at Carleton University here in Ottawa, Ontario. My role is relatively new. I started here at Carleton in 2023, and my position and this new field of work really responds to some of the alarm bells that have been going off within the intelligence community here in Canada and across like-minded countries worldwide. They're cautioning that academia is being targeted by foreign states, especially in research areas that have the potential for both civilian and military applications. So at the ground level, I help facilitate our compliance with the guidelines and policies that were introduced to counter this interference and that now integrate national security considerations into the terms of the funding packages. I also help our researchers to identify and consider risks, and I support the development of risk mitigation plans to safeguard research and make sure that we're going forward with transparent, secure, and mutually beneficial collaborations and partnerships.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And thank you for that additional scene settings. Let's dig in. So, Stephanie, I wonder if we could start with you. In your opinion, how has this historical relationship, however you would characterize it, between academia and the intelligence community shaped the issue of research security in Canada?
So unfortunately, I don't think academia and the intelligence services have necessarily always gotten off on the right foot. In particular, during the Cold War, there was a lot of suspicion, you know, pinko commie profs miseducating the masses. There's concerns, of course, about communism. And the RCMP took a fairly aggressive view of needing to monitor campuses. So, Steve Hewitt, who's a professor in the UK, I believe he's Canadian, has written a lot about this and the key sectors program that was put in place to try and monitor and looking really kind of for any subversive activity, right? And so I think that kind of suspicion has continued to remain. Certainly when the Canadian Security Intelligence Service was created in the 1980s as a result of some of the perceived excesses of the RCMP's national security activities in the 1970s, there were safeguards put in place around universities. So an intelligence service just can't show up on campus. There are certain extra protections that are put in place to make sure, okay, do you really need to see this person? Do you really need to go on campus? Is there any other way you can talk to this person? So I think that there are certain safeguards. But that being said, in the post 9/11 environment, there were also concerns about were security services monitoring certain groups, particularly Muslim groups on campus. So that's always, I think, been a bit of suspicion as well. So again, there have been protections, but I think these concerns have continued. And I'm not sure the intelligence community has done a great job of reassuring some of these communities, including academia, about some of the ways that they act. I think there's always been this kind of level of suspicion. And certainly in my union, when they learned about the creation of these kind of research security programs, they actually issued a letter saying that they were concerned that this may actually impinge on their right of what we call academic freedom. And academic freedom, just to kind of end my comments here, is this idea that academics have the right to pursue knowledge free from interference. You can just look at the US right now and see what, you know, government interference in academia kind of looks like, unfortunately. But there are some concerns that these research security programs, is the government saying or putting limits on academics' right to engage in certain kinds of research. And that, I think, is where we need to have a lot more dialogue, where expressions of concerns on both sides need to be worked out. And we're lucky to have Jessica at Carleton University, because she does a good job, I think, of trying to be the person that tries to connect these different groups together in order to have those conversations.
Thank you for that. And that's an excellent segue to turn to Jessica. So you're on the ground there at Carleton, Jessica, in your discussions with researchers, what's your sense? Do you feel there's sufficient awareness, first of all, of espionage and foreign interference on campus, of this relationship between the intelligence community and academia? And then what additional resources or information do you think you or your researchers would like to see or receive from the intelligence community? I often hear about case studies, but I'd be really interested to hear what else you're hearing from your community.
Thanks, Jacqueline. You know, as far as your question about awareness of espionage and foreign interference, I'd say we're really not there yet. We're working hard in this space, and I feel like we've made some really significant progress in the past few years, but there's still a great deal of work to be done. I think, you know, when we look and ask, why is this awareness lagging? I mean, I think part of this is because we need to do a better job of explaining the different ways that foreign interference manifests itself in our research and innovation ecosystems. So sometimes it looks like intimidation. Sometimes it's a cyber intrusion. Sometimes it's an offer that's just too good to turn down. Another reason is that no one really likes to think that they're being taken advantage of, especially when they're going into something altruistically and with the best of intentions. These are really high-level threats that we're talking about, and I think it can be easy to doubt foreign state interest in your work. From there, you know, it also can be easy to trivialize access vulnerabilities and to view research security protocols as a paper exercise. Universities are not islands. They're influenced by wider society and by the conversations that we're having on the local and national stage. And by and large, across our country, Canadians are realizing that we've been pretty naive when it comes to national security. At Carleton University, no less than 10 years ago, we had a deep cover Russian spy enrolled as an undergrad in our Department of Political Science. Investigative journalism from Bellingcat suggests that he ranked as a colonel within Russia's military intelligence service. So this is not a low-ranking fellow. Now, as we understand it, the job for these Russian spies is to talent spot. They're looking for the people who have sensitive access or who wield influence and power, and who can later be developed through a proper recruitment approach. Carleton University is located in the nation's capital. We are a place where future government officials are trained. So talent spotting here is a real problem. Last year, Russia's Ministry of Justice named NIPSIA, our School of International Affairs, as an undesirable organization. NIPSIA is one of Canada's top graduate programs in this field, and they've effectively sanctioned both the school itself and some of our professors individually, presumably for their great work and for being on the nose about the risks they're seeing and the concerns that they have. So there's no question that we are susceptible to both espionage and foreign interference on campus, both here in Ottawa and across the country. Now, I've given some pretty public examples, but at an individual level, the tricky thing about espionage and foreign interference is that no one really wants to talk about it, especially when it's personalized. Typically, when a person, program, or institution's been taken advantage of, it's managed with delicacy and professionalism. And so by and large, the broader community is not aware that either research or researchers have been compromised. The government's starting to talk about it, and we're talking about it here today. So thank you again for hosting this conversation. But we're up against a good deal of stigma and fear, and I think it's going to be tough to get to that desired level of awareness until this conversation becomes a more open one.
Thank you so much. There's a lot that I'd love to dig into there. But for one thread maybe that I can pull on, you mentioned about, you know, a level of naivete just nationally within our country. I would say we saw a significant amount of attention paid to foreign interference, or more than in the past, at least in Canada in 2024. We've had the passage of the Countering Foreign Interference Act. We saw the Foreign Interference Commission. I'm wondering how you folks see that impacting the information sharing and awareness piece, so the information sharing between academia and the intelligence community, and specifically as it relates back again to research security. Stephanie, I wonder if we could start with you for your thoughts on what difference this might make and what we might expect to see.
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of go to Jessica's point about what this is, I mean, I think just generally there hasn't been a lot of awareness about foreign interference. I mean, I remember when I left government in 2015 and I thought, okay, I'm going to write a book about national security threats. And I did. But I was like, how am I going to talk about what foreign interference is? Because there's just, in 2015, there was no real examples of what this looked like. I mean, there have been some concerns about the Tamil community in Canada that had been made public by Human Rights Watch and things like this. But it really, there really just wasn't a lot out there. And then suddenly 2016 happens in the US election. And I'm like, oh, okay, great. And then I feel like since that time, it's just been nonstop and to the point now where foreign interference is now considered to be a primary national security threat to Canada. And again, looking back to 10 years ago, that just wasn't even a thing. I remember when reporters reached out when then Prime Minister Justin Trudeau went to India and there were allegations of foreign interference then. And they said, well, how does this work? Why would India do this? I was like, oh my goodness. And just having these basic conversations. So there's not the awareness in society. I mean, academia is part of a society, right? So we don't necessarily understand. So where are we going from here in this kind of post Bill C-70 world, which is, of course, as you said, the Act to Counter Foreign Interference? Well, I think the starting point really is that academia and national security agencies, they can really inform each other, right? And if we just look at the past election that we had all these different civil society groups, many of them attached to universities that were looking at the issue of foreign interference. And they can actually look at things that I think national security agencies may actually be reluctant to, right? So they're actually kind of doing a lot of the work of civil society. We don't actually want CSIS scraping the entire internet looking for threats. We're not East Germany in the 1980s. And so this is not something we want. But, you know, when civil society does it and they can present reports, which then can inform national security. So I think if we start from that perspective, we can then move on. So I think there's really three things in place now as we look forward, now that the election's finished. I think the first one is that the infrastructure has been put in place for better information sharing. You know, we have the research security offices, right? I'm talking to you and Jessica. That's the first thing. And a lot of the people in these environments have security backgrounds. They understand the threats. They worked in these areas for some time. But where I think the struggle on the infrastructure side is, you know, the intelligence agencies are going to have to decide for themselves how they want to share that information. And Bill C-70 passed so quickly, I think they've been struggling a little bit with that, right? They, you know, it passed in 45 days, which I think is a record, at least since 2001, with regards to the passage of any national security legislation. So good infrastructure in place, but how it's actually going to work, the mechanics of it, I think still need to be properly worked out. The second thing here gets back to the first question that you asked, which is culture. I think that there still are suspicions on both sides. I spoke about the suspicion of academia. I think intelligence agencies are also suspicious of or concerned at the very least, or a little scared, maybe that's the best way to put it, of sharing that information. And so I think that this is something that's going to have to be overcome, you know, that building that level of trust. And one of the key issues here, and again, not to harp on this issue, but I do think it's important, are concerns around discrimination, are concerns that, you know, certain minority groups or racialized Canadians may be disproportionately impacted just because of, you know, how they grew up, where they grew up, the kind of research incentives that existed 10 years ago when researchers are being told, yeah, go get that money from China. And suddenly they're being told, no, don't get that money from China. This is not great. So I think that we have to, you know, now that we've kind of done this about turn, we need to kind of figure out, okay, well, how is this going to work? How do we build up this trust because of these kind of sudden policy changes? And then the final thing is, I think we have to, both sides need to be constructive, right? On the intelligence side, it can't just be no. on the research security side, it can't just be no. Each side has to help each other. Researchers have to explain what they're trying to achieve in ways that, you know, the community can understand. But also national security agencies, if they just say no to everything, and it's so easy for them to say that, right? It's just easy to kind of use the no stamp. They have to say, okay, we understand what you're trying to do. Can you make these adjustments? Or could you mitigate things in this way? And providing advice, constructive advice on how to kind of resubmit applications or how to do things in a way that protects not just the information, not just, you know, taxpayer-funded research money, but also, as Jessica very elegantly pointed out, the researchers themselves.
I love this idea of the no stamp and moving beyond it.
Move beyond the no stamp, yes.
Exactly. I think you touched on something that's just key to all of this is relationships and having trust in relationships and how we get there. So I wonder if we can dig into that a little more when we think about how we would do that and getting at some of the communications issues that might exist and the perceptions. So Jessica, I wonder if you could tell us, what do you think the intelligence community gets wrong about academia?
You know, that's a million-dollar question. Thanks, Jacqueline. You know, here's the thing. Sometimes I wonder if there's a true understanding of how the academic ecosystem works. And so this is important because it informs the types of approaches that will build that trust that Stephanie's been talking about, both across disciplines and across departments as well. So let me explain. As we know it, the industries and organizations, government departments that employ most Canadians operate with very clear hierarchical structures. Management or ownership sets the operational goals, the performance metrics, and rules of engagement, and then they exercise control to get where they want to go. Academia operates with a far more decentralized and fluid structure. It allows for high degrees of independence within faculties, departments, and even within research groups themselves. So it's entirely possible that an academic's closest working colleague isn't at their own institution at all, but rather in another province or another country where their counterpart is also singularly focused on a particular line of thought or research question. It's also entirely possible that an academic has co-published 3 papers with a handful of authors, including a researcher abroad, without ever having actually interacted or shared data or IP with the foreign researcher. Now, of course, there is an employment structure within academic institutions, but there's also a great deal of autonomy for faculty members, and there can be a great diversity in both protocols and processes from one institution to another. In a sense, academics operate as free agents. Our top researchers are in high demand, the world is their oyster, and if I may, they can sometimes be naive to their own vulnerability. Now, what does this mean for us here for this conversation? I think it can translate to a variety of things. Most clearly, I'll say that if you've talked to one institution, you haven't talked to them all. But also significantly, it means that information can easily be siloed. It's not negligence. It's how you get these high-performing professionals to master their craft, and it's the nature of the business in a way. So frustrating though it may be for the intelligence community, in an academic setting, a good conversation with a key stakeholder just might not reverberate through an institution in the same way that one might in another type of place. We can expect that trust has to build over time and through consistent actions and transparent communications. And I think Stephanie's done a great job of talking to that already.
Thank you for that. I can't tell you how much I wish I'd had you to give me a primer on academia and how it works and the differences between academia and government sector, for example, before I took this job, because some of those have been the primary takeaways certainly that I've had since I've been in this position. So I do think you've touched on a lot of really important points that would help in that trust building and understanding, you know, the differences between how these different segments of our society even work. So Stephanie, I'm going to ask you the converse now, just so we're being balanced. What do you wish, from a perspective of understanding the intelligence community, what do you wish those in the post-secondary community better understood about the intelligence world? And if you have any suggestions, as Jessica did, on how to bridge those gaps, I'd love to hear them.
That's a great question. I think the first thing that surprises people when I talk about it is just how diverse the community is. It's not like a group where everyone has the same ideas or ideology even. I mean, I remember working with people who were fully conversant in anarchist philosophy, you know? And then, like, so you have people who are very conservative, you have people who are very liberal. I remember I worked with someone who was like a Quebec separatist supporter. It really is this diverse community. And that's a good thing because you do not want groupthink. So it really is a place where conversations happen, where there's serious debates over national security issues and how to provide advice on those issues. So I think it's the first thing. The second thing I would love it if academics knew, I think maybe a little better, is just how much the intelligence world needs free, fair, well-funded, quality research to inform policymaking, to inform intelligence collection activities. I mean, I've seen it estimated that up to 80% of information used by intelligence communities is open source, right? And a lot of that material comes from academia. I mean, there was a time where I was in the community and I was asked to look at certain countries. And the first thing I did was pull out books to get familiar with those countries more than I was, right? You're always reading. And so you need research that is critical, that is challenging conventional wisdom, that is grounded in solid research methods, that is going to the places and talking to the people there and telling the public and telling the policy world maybe what they don't want to hear, but what they need to know. And I think this is a really important thing that is not well understood in academia, just how much they are valued and how much their contributions are appreciated.
Thank you for that. I mean, and I think that identifies a lot of common ground that perhaps, again, is something that relationship could be built on. So as we are nearing the end of our time together, I wanted to raise another topic, which is that of sort of metrics and effectiveness, because I've been to a few events lately where the academics have expressed some frustration about the threat that was trying to be described to them and say, well, where's the lack of data or where's the data to show me the scope and scale of foreign interference and espionage? Like, how do I know this is real and how do I know it's really happening in Canada? And I know that in the U.S., the National Science Foundation is now sponsoring some research on research security to help us get at some of this data and to help us start to think in a scholarly and methodological way about how we could start to measure these things and understand if the actions that each of us individually and collectively that we're taking are making a difference when it comes to these threats that we're talking about. So I wonder if either of you have any thoughts on how we might start to assess the effectiveness of our research security actions. Maybe we'll start with you, Jessica.
Sure. Thanks, Jacqueline. Yeah, I mean, this is a tough question, isn't it? As a starting point here, and I'll echo Dr. Tiffert from Stanford's Hoover Institution, we need to agree that research security is not strictly a compliance program. Compliance is necessary, but it's not the only thing. Delivery of a strong program will equally include education and outreach, training, collaboration, and effective governance and standardization. That's really the full suite. So to measure our collective effectiveness, then, it will have to be through a combination of evaluations. It's not just compliance checks, but should also include metrics on employee training, incident reporting, policy benchmarking, and such. Individually, I think there is also a lot of meaning in preemptive outreach when researchers contact a trusted institutional point of contact for guidance on a sticky issue. We may also be in a good time and place to survey researchers, you know, recipients of funds that were tied to NSGRP and STRAT compliance to see what their experience has been and to canvass whether the policies and guidelines have been meaningful, non-discriminatory, and aligned with government and societal expectations. So for me, an effective research security regime would trigger a lasting shift in the mindset and actions of research when it comes to safeguarding both themselves and the work that they're doing. From a metrics perspective, this may be more challenging to quantify. And so I suppose, you know, in part, and I don't know how helpful it is here, but I think there is that old cliche, only time will tell. And so we have a couple years that we need to put in before we start seeing the outputs of this.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Anything that you would add to that, Stephanie, on this topic?
I think Jessica did a really good job of explaining the complexities of this, and not everything is going to be something that we can just quantify, right? It's going to be hard. Every university is different. Every researcher is different. This isn't a tick box exercise. And I like the fact that she expressed the idea that this isn't a compliance project, right? This has to be something more. And I think perhaps in a non-quantitative way, if there's a sense of trust, like a palpable sense of trust that researchers understand this as not just a compliance program, that researchers start proactively reaching out to security offices, then I think you have an idea that this stuff is actually working. Beyond that, I would just kind of echo some of the stuff, again, kind of getting back to some of the threat activity Jessica mentioned, you know, at the beginning of this podcast. A lot of it's about explaining to researchers, this is also about protecting you, right? This isn't about us using the NOSAMP, going back to that, but also this is about, you know, how do we make sure that you're okay, that no one's going to put pressure on you to modify your research or share your research in ways that you don't actually want that to be done. And again, highlighting, can we find ways to highlight the fact that this is, I think it's important for researchers who do feel discriminated against to have some kind of mechanism that they can go to, right? And at least feel that they are heard and ideally have some kind of outcome. And if researchers are aware of those pathways to raise concerns and things like this, and if those concerns can be resolved in as satisfactorily a way as possible, then I think that's going to be another important metric. Although again, I agree that it may not be easily quantifiable for the future.
Thank you so much. I think both of you have made some really important contributions to the way that we're going to think about measuring and evaluating what we're doing here in the coming years. So I really appreciate that. Thank you both so much for being here for this conversation today. I wish throughout all of it that I could be taking notes. So I'm looking forward to reading the transcript for my own purposes later on. There was a lot of really excellent insights shared today. So thank you again. Is there anything that we didn't talk about today that you, either of you, really wanted to share with our listeners on the Power Plant sessions?
I want to thank you for coordinating this session and for crafting such interesting questions and for all of the work and sharing that you do in your role as Director of Research Security at the University of Alberta. We're just really fortunate to have you as part of this community. So thanks to you.
And I guess I would just say to any academics out there, don't be afraid of your research security office. They're genuinely good people. They're there to help and they want to provide reassurance, not just tell you where you got it wrong or portray you as a national security threat. That's in no one's interest, certainly not the university's interest. So if we can set some really good precedents and some really good policies in the next couple of years moving forward. The only other thing I think I would say for the research security officers listening is I always try to advise them, start from the perspective of someone who's just been told no. As you kind of maybe move into this job, or if you're in your job or you're thinking about what is the mindset of the academics are thinking of, think of someone who's scared, who is worried about losing their grant, who is worried about potentially losing their tenure, losing their promotion because they've been told no. So how is it that you would address them and what information would you like them to know going forward? And think, and if you can kind of maybe craft some of your incentives that way, I think that might go a long way forward to appreciating what a more collaborative approach to protecting security for both researchers and research will look like in the future.
Thank you so much. I think that's a perfect place to leave it, and I really appreciate your time today. Thanks for listening to the Power Plant Sessions, our bi-monthly research security podcast. We'll be back August 12th with our next episode focused on mis and disinformation and what this means in the research security context.
This episode of the Power Plant Sessions was hosted by Jacqueline Littlewood and produced by Rachel Zakiewski-Pezin and Andres Alvarez. Jeff Simon created our music, and Renee Hart designed our show art. You can find the Power Plant Sessions on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Subscribe, spread the word, and safeguard your research.